Josh Larson here with the Think Christian podcast. Thanks for joining us for another episode exploring how there's no such thing as secular, even in popular culture. Right at the top here, I wanted to share a recent review we got from a listener identified as used to be productive over at Apple Podcasts. They wrote, "This is a terrific podcast for everyone who wants to explore the evidence of an author's goodness in the creative works of our contemporary world. Josh and his guests celebrate cultural touchstones and how those movies, books, video games, current streaming binges speak to their understandings of faith, rooted in both academic and personal experience. Give a listen and hear how true Christians dialogue as students of the world, seekers of connection, and neighbors to all." Some very kind words there from used to be productive. I hope the TC podcast isn't to blame for your decrease in productivity. Thank you very much for sharing that review. We do love getting feedback like that. And the more reviews we get on Apple Podcasts, the higher our profile, which helps us to find new listeners. So please take a moment or two, if you're listening right now, to leave a review of your own. We appreciate it. After the big roundtable discussion on our last episode, we're back to our usual format today, considering two pieces of pop culture around a central theme. There are a handful of places in the Bible, I often think of Micah 6 verse 8, where we are called to do justice. What exactly does that mean? What does it look like in contemporary society? How might it be reflected in popular culture? Catherine Freeman and J.R. Forasteros are going to help me with those questions, especially as they relate to the recent Netflix series Unbelievable, which is a dramatization of a complicated real-life rape investigation, and we're going to look at the recent run of X-Men comics. What might true crime and mutant mythology have to do with each other? Let's find out by first talking to Catherine Freeman about Unbelievable. Catherine, you and I have been meaning to talk about Netflix's Unbelievable for a little while now. You had a family trip come up, and then our podcast team got together for a retreat. We really missed you there, by the way.
Yeah, I missed you guys too.
Too bad it didn't work out, but I get it. A cruise, that's tempting. I understand. So no blame for that. But here we are, back on track. Schedules are a little more regular, and we're finally able to dig into Unbelievable. This was a difficult watch, but I think an important one, a series that is basically surrounding a couple of rape cases based on actual cases in real life. So yeah, some rough stuff in here. Did you have to pace yourself for this, Catherine? I know a lot of people, when it comes to Netflix stuff, they'll binge it over a weekend. I found it was helpful to kind of give myself breathers between these episodes. How did it work for you?
Yeah, I definitely would say it's probably not bingeable. I felt like it was kind of similar to Netflix's When They See Us. Like, you kind of have to like space out the episodes. And I would definitely say trigger warning, like if you have that in your, it might be a little too close to home.
Definitely.
To watch.
Yeah, that's smart to point out. And maybe before we jump in here, it'll be helpful for those who haven't seen it but are curious about it or watched it a while back and it's starting to fade a little bit of plot synopsis here that we can divvy up, because it does, for much of its running time, follow two different timelines, essentially, or narratives. Maybe you can share where things begin and then I'll pick it up in Colorado.
Yeah. So the first episode, we meet Marie, who is aging out of foster care. She's kind of living in a post-foster care sort of group apartments. And we meet her the morning after she's been brutally sexually assaulted, and come in with her, like, calling her friends, a former foster mom, and then I think the police about what happened. And so that's kind of where it picks up.
Yeah, and the first episode is given largely to the investigation of her case by these two male detectives. And then the second episode brings us to Colorado, I think a couple of years later, and it introduces us to two female detectives, one played by Toni Collette, Grace Rasmussen, who's been on the force for a number of years, really experienced, and then another one, Karen Duvall, played by Merritt Weaver, who is a little bit younger, but she's experienced as well, but definitely younger than Grace Rasmussen. And they are investigating, they're both in Colorado, but in different areas, separate rape cases that they come to believe may be connected. So they team up, and then as the series proceeds, they don't realize it yet, but there is a connection to Marie's case, Marie played by Caitlin Dever in Washington State. And also, there's a real turn there. You know, Marie ends up retracting her report after the police begin to challenge the veracity of it. So as I said, this is based on actual cases, and the whole series, Unbelievable, is spearheaded by Susanna Grant. She's the executive producer, and she's also a writer of these episodes, and I believe she directed two of them. Maybe she's best known as an Oscar nominee for writing Erin Brockovich a number of years ago. What did you think, Catherine, of the show overall? Just it's something of a procedural, but it's also very much interested in the gender dynamics at play within law enforcement. What did you think of it?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I mean, I really enjoyed the characters, like, and just kind of getting to see their whole backstory. Like, I think even with, like, Marie early on, you're kind of given peaks of like, oh, this girl has aged out of foster care. She was moved to a lot of foster homes. So you can kind of see how she was like uniquely vulnerable and then sort of the lack of support. What really struck me about Marie is she had a lot of people in her life that like loved her and thought they were being supportive, but were actually harming her. I think the gender dynamic of when the first Colorado case were first introduced to, I think the victim, her name was Amber, just the difference in response in the way that Detective Duvall and Detective Rasmussen kind of talked to the women victims versus the men who Marie encounters, I thought was really interesting. And what was interesting is I didn't think it was solely like, oh, these men are bad because they're men, because there were men sort of in and around Grace and Karen that were sympathetic and kind. And so it wasn't a straight like, oh, women are better at this than men, but it's very clear that maybe the women detectives had a more trauma-informed approach to sexual assault.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. And you're right. They show those initial two male detectives as being, it's more the system that they're employing that's a problem, as well as their inner, you know, lack of initial belief in Marie. And I'm with you. I think that dichotomy, pairing those two investigations, was the most powerful part of this series. And it is those first two episodes, the way they bookend each other. Those male detectives, it's partly their brusque style. They're very clinical and invasive, I would say, and exhaustive. Like, they're going over everything. It's almost like they just want the information and pay no attention to the person who's involved. That's a distinction. They don't really worry about her psychological or emotional state. I think about that scene where, after all of this barrage of medical exams that she has to undergo as part of the investigation, which they just see as routine, you know, they don't think about what it would be like to go through those. They just hand her a counseling phone number. Like, well, this will take care of that part of it. And then the second episode, when you see Duvall interviewing Amber, she does begin, it's a bit of a personality. She begins by offering comfort, but then she repeatedly checks in on her, asks about her emotional state, provides helpful context for why she's asking these questions. And there's a line of dialogue she gives too when Amber starts to apologize. Duvall says, "You don't have to explain yourself to me." And she takes the shame element, or tries to, out of it a little bit, that I think is crucial. And bringing this around to this idea of justice, you know, in biblical justice, it did strike me that it made me think about the ways that God can work to pursue justice alongside humanity. And sometimes it's simply in who he chooses to do that. And here, it specifically is by putting the investigation in the hands of these two women. That's the way justice is going to prevail and the way he's going to move. So I'm curious how, you know, you thought about this in terms of biblical justice too, Catherine. We're thinking about Micah 6 verse 8 and the call to do justice there. Did you see areas that kind of showed up in Unbelievable?
Yeah, it was really interesting because I think in one of the scenes in the second episode, when Detective Duvall is driving Amber to the hospital, I think in her car, she has a post-it that says, "Here I am, send me." And Amber asks, you know, "What's that about?" And so Detective Duvall goes and explains it's from Isaiah. God is looking for someone to send. And I think about even, you know, we talked about Micah 6:8, but even Isaiah as a prophet, like when you meet him, what he's dealing with in the time of Israel is a lot of rampant societal decay because there's a lack of justice in the land. And so here comes Isaiah speaking into that situation and calling for a return to this sort of covenantal relationship, justice in how we treat the poor and widows and orphans and the hungry and all of those things. And so I just thought it was so fascinating that they started with that, because to your point of like how God uses people, here in earth, in earthly situations, to bring about, to be a part of bringing justice into the world. And so, yeah, I was really struck by that. I also was struck in just talking about Micah 6:8. You know, I thought a lot about the justice aspect, and obviously the women get justice because of Detective Duval and Detective Rasmussen. But I also thought about the second part of that verse about loving kindness, and to what you were saying earlier. I think oftentimes, at least I personally was convicted as someone who's like a hard charging, like, yes, justice, we have to have this. This is what's right. I think sometimes the people and humanity gets lost in that. And I think an equally important part of Micah 6:8 and that command to pursue justice is also how we do it. And so I saw a lot of like, wow, these women are just kind. Like, they're not weak. They're tough. They're courageous. They're brave. They're going into these difficult situations. They're saying these difficult things. But fundamentally, like, they're kind. Like, they see these women as people and are pursuing justice in a way that respects these women and their stories and their trauma, and they're created in the image of godness. And so for me, I was like, oh, wow, like, it really isn't just do justice. Like, really, this other part of the verse is equally important.
Yeah. Yeah. They don't allow the cause to overtake the people. And there are a number of survivors as they narrow in on this suspect. They realize this is a case of a serial rapist. And you're right, Rasmussen and Duval, they both pay attention to the survivors and return to them and follow up with them. It's not just that they get the information they need from them and then move on to pursue the cause, to do the justice. They do remember the people who are still struggling. And I think the courtroom scene we get at the end, where a few of those survivors show up, is a reminder of that as well, that there are real people who are still struggling with this and they're part of this. It's not just a matter of getting that conviction necessarily. You know, I also thought about, while I was watching it, it resonated with this blog post that I remember reading. It's a few years ago, and it was at Red Letter Christians. But Dominique Gilliard was discussing Micah 6, verse 8 there and interpreting it in an interesting way. I think we do think of that do justice phrase as a rallying cry these days in terms of social justice. But Gilliard interpreted it also as an indictment on us right now, not just a rallying cry for our causes. Here's what he wrote. He said, the prophet was imploring the Israelites to understand that believers have to be willing to live lives that are radically different from the rest of the world. The church is to serve as God's prophetic witness in the world today, but we cannot do this when we are more loyal to the norms and laws of our nation than the mandates of our God. And so I think what Gilliard is describing there is like this sense of upending an unjust system rather than being a part of it. And unbelievable is an act of justice in kind of the same double-sided way. So it does pursue justice for the survivors, but it's also really an indictment, isn't it, of this law enforcement system that has treated women unjustly, and then on us too, those of us who have failed to protest that system. So I did sense, especially those first two episodes, really indicting the process itself as unjust. And so it resonated with me in that way.
Yeah, I think, you know, to the something you said earlier about the male cops, it really is the system, right? Part of it is their kind of own brusque personality. But you see even like hints of like the system for dealing with sexual assault, even in the Colorado cases where they're in episode 2, where they, or maybe it's 3, where they go to the FBI and they're asking for like detailed information. And he's like, oh, well, we don't really get that detailed in our reports on rape. Mm-hmm. Like murder, yes, but yeah, not rape. And so everywhere you go, like, you get this sense that if it was not for these two women actively going against the grain or against sort of what had been ingrained in the system, none of these women would have gotten justice. And I think that, you know, the moment we're in culturally, sort of with Me Too and Church Too, like, there is an opportunity for the church to sort of reclaim their prophetic voice on the issue of the treatment of women and sexual assault and sexual abuse. And I think what is always challenging is like, we want to protect our own comfort, our own reputation, the reputation of our church. And I just think that, you know, like, God is building his church, and I don't think he's building it on the backs of women who have been sexually assaulted. And so to the extent that we are like discarding or downplaying those stories because we're uncomfortable, because it's messy, I mean, it's hard. I mean, I think that was one of my big personal takeaways. It's like, oh, wow, like to look at how my own actions and how I would react or I have reacted in similar situations, and really for my own mindset of like, what does it mean to be a good friend, someone that loves justice and kindness and a follower of Christ to someone who, you know, I think Detective Duvall says it's like a crime that never kind of goes away. Like you learn to deal with it, you learn to carry it. And so how do you help people carry that? And how do we help them carry that well?
Yeah, Merritt Weaver is so good as Duvall in these scenes. Yeah. I was unfamiliar with her before, and I was really impressed with how she handled some of that. A very sort of a quiet integrity she has, and the show is clear that her faith is a part of that, I think, which I did find to be interesting. I think that post-it note scene you described is a very good one that handles it really well. But some of the other, I was curious to hear what you thought of how they handled some of the other faith elements, because it got a little clumsy for me. Like there's that parallel sequence at one point. Rasmussen, we should say, is like a huge skeptic, right? She kind of dismisses Duvall's faith and teases her about it. So there's this parallel sequence where Rasmussen is on a morning jog while Duvall is singing In Christ Alone at church. And I thought they were laying out a little thickly there. I liked more the post-it note scene and just Weaver's performance as Duvall herself, where she has this face of seriousness, intent, purpose. You know where that send me attitude comes from and you feel it. I think of that other scene where she's driving alone and starts singing. I think it's like Cock-a-doodle-doo, a silly song to herself. But then she kind of just falls back into repose and you realize that's just not her natural state. She is just this woman driven by this sense of justice while still retaining that kindliness that you mentioned too. So yeah, I loved Weaver's performance, even if I thought some of the faith stuff got a little clumsy here and there.
Yeah, overall, I think it contributed to her level of intensity. Like if I thought about how I would describe them sort of like in the typical like buddy cop movies, like which one she would be, she's like the straight man. Like she's very intense.
Yes, definitely.
You know, Rasmussen is more of a loose cannon. So I thought the scenes that are borderline cheese were kind of trying to get at that intensity. Like she doesn't do anything halfway. She is like intensely in love with Jesus.
That's true. That is true.
But yeah, I feel you on the like, oh, okay, we get it. Like one of them is a Christian, one of them is a heathen, quote unquote.
Yeah, and I think like their dynamic overall, some of the material pushes that, but the performances and those two actresses together, I mean, I just, Toni Collette is one of my favorite actors working, but their dynamic together is really, I like how, to speak to that good cop, bad cop sort of element that's there, I like that they're not buddies ever. You know, they don't ever really become like the best of friends, but they're not adversaries either. They're both on each other's side always. They're always kind of negotiating this shifting middle ground in their relationship that was compelling throughout the whole series. So yeah, I'm glad. I take it you stuck through all the way to the end, Catherine?
Yeah.
Yeah. Is there anything else, you know, we should touch on? Maybe not specific spoilers in case people do want to still check it out, but anything else you wanted to bring up about Unbelievable before we go?
I think what I really loved about it is just the complex portrayal of women in, I think oftentimes in media, women are either, you know, wives or mothers or sort of, I don't know. I just feel like it's very rare to see the fullness of women's lives. And I loved that Detective Duvall, those instances where she's late for dinner, her husband makes dinner, or she's still like this anxious mom. Even in the way the different victims' lives and how they handle the trauma, like as if to say that like there's no one right way to deal with this and like there's not like a perfect way to handle something that traumatic. And so I really appreciated just like the complexity of the storytelling, because for me, I think, you know, of the scene where the foster mom takes Marie to get new sheets and the mom is like, well, if I were you, I wouldn't want to sleep on the same sheets. And like Marie's reaction is totally different. Like, I think we do that. And we use that like perfect victim or how we would act as an excuse, you know, to dismiss or diminish women's stories.
Or to move on, you know. If you just get the right set of sheets, you can move on.
Yeah. If you just do this thing, and I know the right thing that you should do, like you can just be over it. And I just felt like sort of those small, like subtle moments of storytelling added up to this really big, beautiful, messy, hard, I don't know. It just felt more true.
I really liked it. Just a small detail, but it's fun to see they each have their husbands who are pretty much only seen at home, right? It's a total flip of what we're used to in a procedural where there is the long-suffering wife making dinner at home. They both have husbands that they're always late to. They're always missing dinner.
Yeah.
And it's just nice to see that turned the other way around, you know?
Yeah,
kind of refreshing.
Sure.
All right, before I let you go, since you did miss the retreat, you couldn't be a part of that roundtable recording that we made. It's in the podcast feed. It's the previous episode, but the rest of the podcasters got together, and I wanted to give you a chance, Catherine, to weigh in on what we talked about there. I basically asked them, is there a piece of pop culture you would describe as being spiritually formative for you? So something that's functioned in your life almost like liturgy. You know, you keep coming back to it as a person of faith. It has a special resonance to you. Maybe it's challenging. Maybe it's affirming. We hit everything from TV shows to albums to movies to a book. So yeah, I don't know if you've had anything come to mind along those lines. We can get your take too.
Yeah, you know, I thought about it long and hard. And I will say, because we were not allowed to consume a lot of pop culture as children. And the thing that I kept coming to was just like sports. I mean, I know that's like really general. We were like a huge sports family. And I think even I didn't really play, like my siblings were and my dad like watched. I find even now when I watch, you know, LeBron James and like when he went over to Luka and was like, you're doing so awesome. Like these sort of like, wow, that's like discipleship and we should be cheering for the people coming after us. And so I think generally in sports stories, there just is so much there and complexity. And I can just think of a number of different like sporting events, you know, where there was some moment that I'm like, wow, like that's the gospel, that's the church, like that's, you know, what this is. And so I think for me, like it's kind of random. I'm sure everyone expected me to say something about Beyonce.
No, but I get it. And there's definitely a liturgical element to the fact of seasons of, you know, each sport has a season and there are, Well, hey, that doesn't shock me. You're the person who's been on this show to talk NBA playoffs. So yeah, I'm not really too surprised by that answer. And we should probably wrap up before you and I dive into the start of the NBA season and go on a tangent on that. We'll save that maybe for another show. How does that sound?
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks, Catherine.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today.
As if you need to be told, that was the inimitable Marvin Gaye and his classic lament, What's Going On, from his 1971 album of the same name. And when anyone brings up the idea of God's justice and music, this is one of the first songs and albums that comes to mind for me. Hi, John J. Thompson here, in-house DJ for the Think Christian podcast, and I curate a special playlist for each episode, and this one is no different. What's Going On is such an amazing, almost miraculous track that I think it belongs front and center in any musical reflection on justice from a theological perspective. Marvin Gaye, though already an R&B superstar, was both creatively and personally struggling as the 1960s ended. The Vietnam War, drug abuse, crippling inner-city poverty, and the failure of the American dream, systemic racism, and even environmental issues all weighed heavily on his soul, making it impossible for him to croon more simple love songs, so he didn't. He channeled his energy into the creation of a layered, three-dimensional, even transformational project that opens with this song, a song that starts with a party for his own brother's return from Vietnam, but evolves into a sort of prayer. The album closes with the amazing Inner City Blues, a song that shows up on this playlist via a cover version by Adam Again. I hope you'll dig this collection, and Lord knows this is just the tip of the iceberg, but with songs from the Avett Brothers, Janelle Monáe, Jars of Clay, Chance the Rapper, Stevie Wonder, and many others, it's at least a good scratch. You'll hear a bit of Sheryl Crow and Jason Isbell's cover of Bob Dylan's Everything Is Broken later in this episode. You may have seen my review of her latest album, Threads, from which this track is lifted at Think Christian recently. You should know how this works by now. Just search for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify or find the link in the email you get if you subscribe to the email list. If you follow the latest episode playlist, the newest one will always be there in your browser. But you can also find each episode's batch listed separately under the Think Christian profile. And of course, we combine all of the playlists into one massive archive, so you can follow that as well. And as always, if you think of any great songs I should add, feel free to tweet at me at John J. Thompson, and I will take your suggestions under advisement. Until next time, turn it up and keep it real.
Hi, Think Christian listeners. I'm Wade Beard.
And I'm Kevin McClenathan.
And we just wanted to drop in and let you know about our film and TV podcast, Seeing and Believing.
Every week, we take two movies or television shows, mostly current releases, but sometimes classics. We delve into their narrative and technical aspects and explore their spiritual and religious themes.
To hear us search for the sacred on screen, just hop on over to iTunes and look for Seeing and Believing.
Josh Larson here, back with the TC Podcast. Now, I'm not the biggest comic book aficionado. I sort of just play one for this show, but I do love that it gives me the excuse to read a series here or there to catch up with a few things. I do, though, have to depend on folks like J.R. Forasteros to let me know what's interesting in the comics world. J.R., you highlighted the latest X-Men run written by Jonathan Hickman, and so I did check out the 6-issue House of X series, and it was just fantastic. I really enjoyed it. Thanks for pointing me in that direction. Can you share a bit of background, maybe on Hickman, but then also how House of X does fit into the larger X-Men narrative?
Yeah, you know, for folks who follow comics, they might be aware that the X-Men universe at Marvel has been in flux. And a lot of people think it's because they didn't own the X-Men movies. And, you know, they've been trying to do all of that connection. So X-Men created back in the 60s have always been a major part of the Marvel universe, but in the last decade or so have been kind of laying fallow. And part of the problem is you have, like, I don't know, 50 million X-Men characters. It seems like it's really hard to keep up with who's who. I mean, once you get past like Professor X, Jean Grey, Wolverine, Cyclops, you know, once you get past kind of the all-stars, it just seems impossible to keep track of. At any given time, there's like 10 or 15 different X-something comic books, X-Force, X-Men, X-this, X-that. And so Marvel brought in Jonathan Hickman, who has just finished up this monumental run on Fantastic Four that was years long, that turned into this sprawling sci-fi opera, like space opera, fantasy epic kind of thing. And so he's used to doing these big operatic stories. So they brought him in and they announced Jonathan Hickman is relaunching the X-Men. And so that means, you know, kind of resetting everything. If you weren't sure where to jump in on X-Men, here's where you can start. And then, of course, no one knew what to expect, except that it was going to be big. It was going to be audacious. It was probably going to be different from anything we'd seen before. And sure enough, House of X, and then he did a companion book called Powers of 10, where the 10 was still an X. They insisted it's House of X and Powers of 10 that just finished up. And yeah, it's created a whole new status quo for the X-Men moving forward.
Well, that's been my experience too, because definitely familiar with the X-Men and had read other comics, you know, probably years back, and I've seen most of the movies, but I really did not keep up with, you know, what had been happening lately. And you're absolutely right. The universe expanded and it got overwhelming, but I was able to jump right in here, at least with the House of X issues, and had my bearings, had enough context to bring to it, and also could sense how this was sort of a new direction. Is it fair to say, my understanding is this new direction is kind of this idea that Professor X and Magneto together have to establish a mutant nation, a sovereign nation rooted really on this island of Krakoa, but also part of the island is that you can access it from anywhere if you're a mutant, and that this is kind of the step forward that Hickman is bringing to the franchise. Is that fair?
That's right. Yeah. And bringing every mutant together under one national umbrella, right? They offered amnesty to all of the villains, right? So Apocalypse is there. Mr. Sinister is there. Again, Magneto and Professor X on the same page, kind of for the first time officially in the X-Men history. The classic thing has always been that they want the same thing, but in different ways. And it, yeah, very much seems that Professor X is kind of agreeing with Magneto at this point, that there is no way that humans are ever going to accept mutants, and so mutants need to take care of themselves first.
So there's a central question right there of how to pursue this justice for mutants. And I think it shows up in a number of ways in the House of X run. Probably the biggest picture one, though, that I want to start with is the idea of establishing this sovereign mutant nation, this nation of Krakoa. And I like Magneto's reasoning for this that he gives early on. There are some UN ambassadors, I think it is, who are visiting because they're trying to negotiate with them of how this is going to work within global policy. And Magneto says, we've never conquered a people, stolen their lands, or made slaves of the vanquished. And so he's very much setting this mutant nation apart from the injustices of human history and wanting to move in a different, more just direction. So I think Krakoa itself is a very biblical vision of pursuing justice, actually. I think Christian has a partner program and a podcast called Groundwork. It's a Bible study program. I think I've mentioned it on the show before, but they had an episode that did consider the Bible's definition of justice. And I wanted to share a little bit what co-host Dave Bass said there, because I think it applies here to House of X. But Bass said the Bible presents a vision of what a good society looks like. It shows us a picture of a community where there is flourishing for all people, where there is opportunity for all people. A biblical understanding of justice is a community or a society where God's will is done, where God's righteousness is expressed in relationships. So that's sort of, JR, what Magneto and Professor X are trying to establish with Krakoa, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, they create this quiet council that's like the ruling council of Krakoa. And there's only three laws, which I think you can find all three of them in the creation story in Genesis. It's make more mutants, which is very much the be fruitful and multiply. There's the respect the sacred land, which is where when God puts the man in the garden, he says, till and keep the earth, right? That's the respect the sacred land. And then murder no human, no person. And again, if you go to Cain and Abel, right, that's the first sin. Well, obviously the first sin after eating from the tree, right? But yeah, you can find all three of those laws that Magneto and Professor X and the Quiet Council establish are very much in line with what we see like in the earliest stories of humanity in scripture.
And there's very much a Genesis feel to how Krakoa is drawn and depicted, the artistry in the comic here. It's very fertile. It is flourishing. There's fauna, and it's really an arresting vision. The lead artists are Arby Silva and Pepe Larraz. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct, yes.
Are you familiar with some of their other work or just kind of the—
I really am not. Okay. I mean, the art in this was just really good. It was so clear and vivid. And I think especially, you know, sometimes it's difficult to keep track of so many different characters, and they did a good job of making everyone distinct. I am a little worried. I mean, it's hard not to feel like if something's too good to be true, it probably is. And the fact that Xavier's face is always behind this new helmet that he has.
Yeah.
You know, it felt very sinister to me. You know?
Interesting. Yeah, because we are used to seeing Professor X and relating to him as, you know, he presents himself as just very human. And his powers are the powers of the mind. So they're not out front like that. But the choice to put him behind this helmet is very distinctive, and I can see how you might read it as possibly threatening. It's interesting how Magneto takes his helmet, which is also intimidating, on and off a lot in these issues, maybe even more so now that I think about it than Professor X. So yeah, there might be something going on there. When you and I were first talking about how House of X might fit with the Do Justice theme, you mentioned a subplot that has to do with the brutal mutant Sabretooth. You already brought up this idea of amnesty that Professor X wants to grant to all mutants to bring them to Krakoa. Can you tell me a little bit about how this plays out in this subplot with Sabretooth?
Yeah, so, you know, Sabretooth is one of the classic Wolverine villains, and he's very similar to Wolverine. He has healing factor, he's brutal, he's animalistic, if you might guess from his name, and he kills someone. I mean, he kills lots of people throughout his tenure as a villain, but he kills someone in this series. And so because he breaks one of those three laws, they decide to punish him. And of course, they're not going to execute him because their own law is do not kill anyone. They punish him by essentially mandating this sort of like permanent half-living exile where he's descended into the bowels of Krakoa and kept in a kind of a stasis. And what made me so interested in it is because you were asking, you know, for some comics that might relate to the theme of biblical justice. And what I see here and what I hope that is going to come back in the series at some point is that This is a kind of justice that does not allow for the possibility of restoration. You know, Sabretooth is in stasis. He's not conscious. He's not able to think. He's not able to reflect, to repent, to change in any way. And so, you know, if 1,000 years from now they take him out of stasis, he's going to be the exact same as when he went in.
Yeah, yeah. That's interesting. I know in that sequence, there is a panel where, and I forget who says it, raises the question of redemption. I don't know if they use that word, but raises the question and leaves it as a question. So you're right. They emphasize that you're not going to be conscious in this state. You won't be dead, but you're not going to be conscious. So it does take away his free will, either towards evil or towards repentance, as you're suggesting. But there is a certain question there, too, that they kind of ask, you know, it's yet to see if there's the possibility of redemption. So following that through line down the road will definitely be interesting. And that decision that they make near the end on Krakoa is distinct. The first time we see Sabretooth, he's before a human judge, a human court, that we get the sense he's rescued by mutants before the sentence comes down, but it's not going to be very lenient at all. This is like a supermax prison slash courthouse where he's been caught for those murders. And so it's interesting to juxtapose that sequence with what we see later in the film where he receives a different sort of judgment, harsh one as well, as you point out. I think too, don't they say one reason they put him in stasis like that, and this is another thing I wanted to talk about in terms of House of X, is this idea of resurrection that comes into play in this series. Professor X, alongside 5 other mutants who have these cooperative powers, they've basically found a way to copy a mutant's mind. And then in a case where a mutant has died or been killed by humans, they can put that mind into a new body that's been grown there on Krakoa using these other 5 mutants, their powers. And so one reason Sabretooth is put in this stasis is because I think someone mentions to execute you would just enable you to come back. Like there is this process now for you to come back. So that's why they make that choice. So obviously this resurrection idea, you know, deeply religious, deeply spiritual, but was interesting to me, maybe because it was on my mind, that it points to the justice of the resurrection, the justice that's part of Christ's resurrection too, in the way it's depicted here. This idea that resurrection is coming back to defeat death in a way that death is the ultimate injustice. And again, going back to the artwork, the way this is depicted, these rebirths are from these glowing giant eggs that lie beneath this huge tree on Krakoa. And it made me think it was sort of like Alien and Avatar on Easter morning, all coming together in this one panel. And there's even a comment made when these resurrections do take place. I think it's Storm who says this. She describes it in terms of justice. She says, by doing this, they have righted the wrongs of man and defeated our great enemy, death. You think of the resurrection in terms often how it's personally applicable, but this was interesting to me because it made me think about the resurrection in terms of an ultimate cosmic act of justice, really. I think that's what House of X made me realize.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And it works both ways, right? There are those who are innocent, who are victims of great wrong, who are killed, right? And then there are also those who are the perpetrators of great wrong, who die without ever facing any consequence. And yeah, I think you're exactly right. The final resurrection is a part and parcel of that, is God bringing justice. I couldn't help but think of Hebrews 11. You know, we call it the Hall of Faith, but what the author of Hebrews is doing in that chapter is saying, here's like a nearly countless string of people who were faithful to God, who died without receiving the full promise of Christ in us, the hope of glory, right? And so their faith was this very specific thing. It was this thing that shaped their present reality because they were trusting that God was going to do what God had promised to do. They died before they received the fulfillment of that promise. And so, of course, the resurrection is their hope too, that God will finally fulfill all of God's promises.
For sure, for sure. Yeah, there was a lot of good stuff in here. You know, again, we kind of hooked it on that Sabretooth idea. And then as I started reading, I just kept finding more and more. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on? I think you read Powers of 10. I was not able to get to that. So we haven't even dug into that.
It's a whole different thing. Honestly, I think that for however many 2, 3, 4 years, however long Hickman's run goes, I think we've just seen the tip of the iceberg. So, I mean, I really think if you're someone who loves theology and comics, any of Hickman's stuff is just really fertile for that. And he's really good at handling a big cast of characters. I mean, the Fantastic Four has like the future. We don't even have to go there, but I'm really anxious to see what Hickman's X-Men is going to do to revitalize this franchise.
Well, and to your point, Fantastic Four show up briefly in this House of X issues, this series, and it wasn't disorienting for me, who had not had that back context. He really can juggle in a lot of ways, you know, which has sort of been a downfall of some of the X-Men movies for me, juggling these massive casts. Hickman as a writer has really shown that he's able to do that in this format quite well. Well, thanks, JR. You have been very busy for us. In addition to keeping up with House of X, you've been writing for the website on the HBO series Righteous Gemstones. I know you're going to write about the Fred Rogers biopic, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. So pretty sure Righteous Gemstones will be on the site by the time this episode goes live. But if they're not, they will be there soon. So thanks for all the good work, my friend.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to meet you. Unbroken plows, broken treaties, broken vows, broken pipes, broken tools, people bending, broken rules. Heimdall, Hallett, Bullfrog, Croaky, everything's broken.
Sheryl Crow there on Everything is Broken, which also features Jason Isbell. That one, a lament and a call for justice. Originally written, as John J. Thompson mentioned earlier in the show, by one of our pop prophets, Bob Dylan. If everything is broken, we're called to come alongside God and his grand plan to fix it. That's doing justice. Thanks to Catherine Freeman and J.R. Forasteros for pointing out what that fixing looks like in Netflix's Unbelievable and Jonathan Hickman's House of X series. At Catherine Annette is where you'll find Catherine on Twitter. Look for JR at JR Forasteros. I'm at Larson on Film. I'm on Facebook as Larson on Film as well. Think Christian. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for at Think Christian. Now, as John J. Thompson also mentioned, Everything is Broken and a whole bunch of other songs, justice-themed songs, can be found on the Spotify playlist that he curated for this episode. You can find it by searching for the Think Christian playlist on Spotify. Next show, we're going to dig even more deeply into music, specifically Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds' latest album, Ghostine. We're going to consider that alongside Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, which I've seen and is really, really good. We're going to ask how both deal with the heavy theme of mortality. Cheery, I know, but they wrestle with it in really rich ways. So check that album out and the film out if you can. I know The Irishman is already in some theaters, and it's going to hit Netflix on November 27. That way you can be a part of things the next time we explore how our pop culture fandom resonates with our faith. If you have thoughts about this episode or the show in general and want to send them to me directly, you can always email me. I'm Josh Larson, and you can reach me at jlarson@reframemedia.com. That's J-L-A-R-S-E-N. At reframemedia.com. The Think Christian podcast is a production of Reframe Media, a family of programs designed to help you see your whole life reframed by God's gospel story. Visit reframemedia.com for more info. Our audio engineer and post-production supervisor is John Reeder. Lastly, a note of thanks to the Communication Arts Department at Trinity Christian College in Palos Heights, Illinois, which provided the recording space for this episode. You can learn more at trnty.edu. And go Trolls.